Walter Kern is an expert spinner of tales, such as the novels Up in the Air and Thumbsucker, both motion pictures. But nothing in his rich imagination could match the elaborate, high-stakes fiction concocted by Christian Carl Gerhardsreiter, a.k.a. Clark Rockefeller, recently sentenced to life in a much-publicized murder trial. In his book Blood Will Out, Kern describes the elaborate and cold-blooded con that Gerhardsreiter pulled on himself and dozens of others for decades. It is a great pleasure to welcome Walter Kern to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
I am thrilled to be here.
It is very nice to have you aboard. Listening to this story and reading about it and then having people respond to it has really been incredible, because it is the story of you. Mm-hmm. And of course, this man, but you being completely fooled.
Yes, yes. I mean, you know, in this age of Google and so on, when we think we can check up on other people and, you know, do instant verification of each other's identities, it seems a little exotic that somebody could be completely duped for 10 years by a con man and killer, especially a journalist like me. So, you know, it is an exotic story for the times.
Give us a sense of how you met, and this is one of those things, mm-hmm. do we call him Clark or Christian?
I call him Clark only because he had about 20 different names, and you have to choose one, and I knew him as Clark, and it's still not entirely real to me that he wasn't. I met him in 1998 in a very strange circumstance. I was living in Montana, where I still live. A dog came into the local animal shelter that had been shot and run over and was paralyzed in the back half of its body, used a wheelchair, and needed a very special owner who could give it a lot of attention, even a lot of medical attention. So the dog was put up for adoption on the internet, and they got a call from a man in New York City, Clark Rockefeller, and he said, "I'd love to take care of this dog. There's only one problem. I can't get out there to pick it up myself. I don't have a driver's license, and though my private plane would be a great way to transport it, it's in China with my wife." So Humane Society came to me and said, "Walter, you lived on the East Coast. Maybe you can talk to this Rockefeller guy." They were a little intimidated by him. And I got on the phone with him, and I knew within 10 minutes that I'd met the most eccentric person I'd ever come across, and that as a novelist, as I say in the book, it would be professional malpractice not to get to know him a little better. So I ended up driving the dog. I thought I was going to drive it all the way to New York City. I got to Minneapolis, 1,000 miles into the journey, and had a nervous breakdown, so I flew the rest of the way. But anyway, that's how I met him.
And just the meeting is he described himself as kind of a David Hyde Pierce type.
Yeah, he said the character of Niles, the little brother on the show Frasier, was based on him, and that I would recognize him by his resemblance to the actor. And when I got to LaGuardia Airport and looked around as I came down the escalator, I didn't see anybody who looked like that, but I did see a guy in a pink polo shirt and a pink cap, and he was unmistakably this rather posh, fancy person I'd met on the phone.
I guess that's what is so fascinating about the story and what his ultimate craft was, which was to create a story where you fill in the blanks and it makes perfect sense. So if somebody talks to you and says that they are a Rockefeller and then tells you that the plane is out because it's with their mm-hmm. wife in China, that makes sense.
Well, you see, he knew something that only the very best con artists know, which is that a story that the victim tells to himself is much more convincing than a story that is told to him. So he dropped all these sorts of clues as to his lifestyle and his identity and left me to fill in the blanks. And he knew, I think, probably from talking to me for 5 minutes, that I had an imagination and that I would fill in the blanks in the most interesting ways possible. And so I was hooked. It was not just that, you know, I wanted to hang out with a Rockefeller and have insight into how they live, but because I was intrigued by the stories and the narratives that he spun.
How did the friendship develop over time? I mean, you write about it in the book, and it's fascinating because it is one thing leading to another.
Mm-hmm.
And of the point where, again, just to underscore what you just said, mm-hmm. which is there was always that you're filling in the blank, you have the imaginative mind, mm-hmm. so that at no time you're questioning the existence.
Well, he never gave me time to question things. You know, first I met him in New York City, and he brought me over to his apartment and showed me his fabulous art collection of Rothkos and Pollocks. And it seemed to be, you know, something that would be worth tens of millions of dollars. He even had and I don't know to this day whether this was an actor or a real person, a restorer from the Museum of Modern Art come in while I was in his apartment and start, you know, wiping little spots off the paintings hanging on the walls. You know, after that first meeting, which really sort of sold me on his authenticity, I started to get to know him as a person. And ultimately, I visited him at this mansion he had in Cornish, New Hampshire. I sat with him in very fancy private clubs in New York City. But the relationship deepened most after his divorce in about 2006, because I had been divorced. We both had daughters. We both missed our children, weren't seeing them as much as we liked. And it wasn't just a sort of recreational friendship at that point of two guys, you know, joking around in clubs. It was two men of, you know, advancing middle age, sort of mourning things that had happened in their lives.
When you think of his background, I mean, the first time he met you, when you went to the apartment, he said, "Do you want to take a private tour of Rockefeller Center?"
Yeah. I was the first night we were sort of together socially. We were sitting atop a Manhattan skyscraper, looking down from this private dining room on Rockefeller Center. I mean, we're that high up in the sky. And as dinner ended, sort of late in the evening, he said, "Would you want to have some fun? We can go take a tour of Rockefeller Center. I have the key, suggesting that there was a master key, and it was there in his pocket, which he was padding. Now, he never brought it out and showed it to me, and I didn't take him up on the offer because it was 10 o'clock at night, and it seemed like a sort of social offer, not something you necessarily said yes to. But those kind of bold strokes, those almost absurdly brave lies and boasts were common with him.
So when you go to the apartment or you go to the mansion, there was money there, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it turns out it was his wife's money. He had a wife who was a very successful business person. But, you know, it appeared there was money there, though the apartment was strange. It had, you know, what was a gallery's worth of modern art on the wall, but only one piece of furniture that I remember, which was a pretty lousy couch with dog hair all over it. And I thought, oh, he's an eccentric. He doesn't care at all about his environment. He just cares about great art. So there's an example of how I was constantly justifying and rationalizing and excusing sort of moments of suspicion.
There is a geographical divide between the two of you often. So how often would you see him?
Well, I saw him when I would come to New York, and it was only a few times. He was always bothering me to come visit him once he'd moved to New Hampshire. Now, in retrospect, he left New York City and moved to rural New Hampshire, I think, to avoid legal scrutiny. You know, he was a fugitive the whole time I knew him, secretly hiding out from a murder investigation. But he would, you know, implore me to come to New Hampshire. And he finally got me to go by saying that we'd meet J.D. Salinger, who was a neighbor of his and was actually a neighbor of his there. So I, you know, one time on a trip to Boston, went up for the weekend to see him. And it was one of the spookiest weekends of my life. It really was strange.
How so?
Well, I got there and the house was just in shambles. It was all jacked up, on building jacks, and some of the windows weren't even installed yet. And he showed me to a bedroom that was, empty, with a bed practically on the floor. We went to dinner. At one point, he forgot his wallet, didn't pay, which irritated me. At another point, he played what I think was one of his greatest tricks ever. I said, I have this little tax problem. I've got a couple $1,000s that I owe to the government, and they say they're going to go into my bank account and take it. And he said, well, why don't you just call my friend George? And he wrote down a phone number, and he handed it to me. And what he meant by George was the president of the United States, George Bush Jr. And he told me that if I dialed the number, Bush himself would pick up. It wouldn't go through a secretary. And imagine the thing was actually radioactive in my hand. I thought, if I dial this, the Secret Service is going to land in a helicopter on my lawn.
Right.
But he also told me while I was up there that he had a secret lab just over the border in Quebec, which did research for the Defense Department on rocket propulsion systems. And he said, would you like to see a picture of it? I said, sure, this secret lab. And it was just a picture of a forest taken from the air. And he said, the lab is right under all those trees.
Mm-hmm. In reading the book, you can't, or I had trouble of thinking of either this is, one of the sickest people that that you'll ever meet, or one of the most brilliant.
Both.
That you'll ever meet.
Both. He's the sickest person I ever met. And I hesitate to use the word sick, because sick suggests that somebody's in the throes of some uncontrollable condition. This was one of the most calculating, manipulative, and conscious people I've ever met. He had a photographic memory. He, at trial, it turned out he had 20 phone lines in that house in New Hampshire that rang on different area codes so he could call people and pretend to be in different places. I mean, this is a mastermind.
Ultimately, on the run from a 1985 murder.
Yes.
And what I find fascinating is what do you think he was ultimately trying to get from you in the relationship?
Well, that's an interesting question. He wanted to be a writer, and he told me at many points during our friendship that he had written books that he wanted me to edit. I also know, after his murder trial was concluded and I saw him in prison, that he had a multi-thousand-page novel he'd written about the history of Europe. He sent me sonnets that he'd written from jail, very strange sonnets about things like the German electoral system. Anyway, I think he wanted to be close to a writer. He fancied himself a literary character. I also think unconsciously, and this is a strange concept, that he knew at some level that someday he'd be exposed, and he wanted someone to write about him. I mean, after his trial, somebody turned to me in the courtroom and said, "Now I know why he cultivated a friendship with you. He hoped that you would make him famous."
Did that ever deter you?
Well, early on in the relationship, I one of the reasons I got to know him was that I thought I would base a character on him someday. Mm. I then decided that in deference to our friendship, I couldn't do that. When he was exposed in 2008 as, an imposter and a murder suspect, I all bets were off, and I decided I can write about him in good conscience. But even now, I think as he sits in jail there, he's probably writing, he's probably studying the press he's getting. I'm sure he's very conscious of this book being out, for example. He saw himself as a incredibly interesting character, and I think he's probably even enjoying in a sick way the fame that comes of being evil and getting caught.
Hmm. But do you ever feel guilty about that aspect?
Not so far. When I saw him in jail after he was sentenced last August, he's about to go off to life in prison. And actually, it wasn't in jail. It was in the courtroom just after the sentencing. And I sat down with him to interview him. The judge said, "You can have a few minutes with him." And his first words to me were, because he knew I'd written a piece in The New Yorker about the trial, he said, "You betrayed me." And for a second, it shook me. And I looked back at him and I thought, my God, what a hypocrite. What a crazy person. Mm. He betrayed me and everyone else in his life with every breath, and yet he's judging others.
When you were in the courtroom, there was that moment where he looked at you, he saw you, obviously he knew you, you write about it beautifully in the book, and you thought he would give you some sort of knowing glance, but instead it was more of a sneer.
It was worse than a sneer. It was like a Doberman pincher looking at you through a chain link fence. If he could have bit me, he would have. He sort of sneered, his nostrils wrinkled up, and he seemed to be saying, you know, you're not the gentleman you pretended to be. That scared me, because at that point I didn't know that he'd be found guilty. I thought I might have to deal with this character once this trial was over. He might easily get off and become some kind of, you know, perverse, strange superstar, you know.
What kind of trust issues does it bring up when you realize that you've been friends with a murderer for more than a decade?
Well, you know, I've met people who found out that their husband had another family. I've met people who found out that their business partner was embezzling, you know, and that causes a crisis of trust. This is even, I think, more acute and intense than those moments of exposure. For me, in the months and even the years after him being found out, I looked over my shoulder. If I had to let somebody into my house, you know, give them a key so they could fix the plumbing, I wondered if they weren't going to rifle through my things. I'd get phone calls, the kind of phone calls we all get, you know, somebody offering us a credit card or whatever, and I'd wonder if it was a scam. Society is based in pretty much every interaction on the assumption that the other person is trustworthy. And when that goes, you're almost paralyzed. You're very isolated. And I really had to work through that afterwards.
Was there any solace in talking to other people who had relationships with him?
Yes. Yes, absolutely. The trial was like a reunion of his dupes. All these people who hadn't known each other, who'd, you know, been isolated in their dealings with him, suddenly came together and were able to compare stories. It was like a victim support group almost. And, you know, I realized that he fooled everyone until suddenly he fooled no one. And there was really no dishonor in having been fooled by him. But by comparing people's stories, I was able to settle on the strategies he used, and this book is really a kind of anatomy, not of a murder, but of a con, and how all cons have something in common.
And when you think about what he was able to do, at least I got this impression that it's certainly elaborate, but again, something that could be replicated.
Oh yeah, I mean, you know, the same month that Clark was exposed as Christian Karl Gerhardt's writer, German immigrant who had come over here at 17 and started imitating fancy blue blood Americans, that same month, Lehman Brothers was exposed as a sort of giant casino operation that had lost billions of dollars. Bernie Madoff was exposed as the operator of world's largest Ponzi scheme. I saw that the way in which you gain people's trust and then and take advantage of them is happening at every level, and that, you know, Wall Street gone bad especially was not all that different than Clark Rockefeller. They put a fancy name out front, Lehman Brothers. They give you the sense of a wonderful history of probity and you know, responsibility, and then they pick your pocket. And that's really only a bigger organized version of what he did.
When you think about that Rockefeller connection, at what point, I mean, there was the moment when you found out, and what's that like?
Yeah, well, it doesn't happen suddenly. When he kidnapped his daughter and the Rockefeller family came out and said, we don't know this guy, we don't know who he is, he's not related to us, my first response was, you're lying. This guy's brought shame on this famous family, and you're pretending he's not one of you, you don't know him. I gave up very grudgingly my belief in him. But when it was really shattered was when he was named a suspect in this murder, and certain things about the circumstances around the murder accorded with things he'd told me in conversation in other contexts, and it suddenly hit me, not only was he fake, he was a killer, and a grisly killer. And it was like falling through space. It was like a trap door opened under my chair.
And as you just indicated, there were elements of truth. Even though it was a con, there were elements of truth.
Well, yeah, there are always elements of truth in a con, you know. This one was one that he spent 24 hours a day on. I mean, even in his sleep, he was probably dreaming about how to manipulate people. You know, you're pretty defenseless against somebody whose entire life, entire energy, and entire mind are spent trying to hide and massage and change the truth. You know, the rest of us have jobs.
It is a fascinating tale. The book is Blood Will Out, the true story of a murder, a mystery, and a masquerade. Walter Curran, thank you so much for sharing with us.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. Again, the title of the book, Blood Will Out by Walter Curran. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.